Going to the Major. The Commissars asked us to avenge the blood wrong, and I for one am happy to oblige. Corbeck hadn't mentioned that he'd only selected Larkin because of his fine stealth abilities, nor had he made clear Gaunt's real reason for the raid. Distraction, misdirection, and, like the Janteen, to promote the notion that what was really happening aboard the Absalom was a mindless soldier's feud. Now, checking the long gun, Larkin seemed to relax. His only eloquence was with a firearm. If he was going to break ship law, then best do it full measure, with a gun in his hands, and they all knew he was the best shot in the regiment. They edged on into the Janteen barrack area. From down one long cross hallway came the sounds of singing and carousing, from another the clash of shock poles in a training vault.
"How far do we go with this?" McCall whispered.
Corbeck shrugged.
"They killed three, wounded two.
We should match that at least." He also had an urge to discover Rawn's fate, and rescue him if they could, but he suspected the Major was already long dead. McCall, the commander of the scout platoon, was the best stealther they had. With Baru at his side, the pair melted into the hall shadows and swept ahead. The other three waited. There seemed to be something sporadic and ill at ease in the distant rhythm of the ship's engines as they vibrated the deck.
"I hope we're not running into some fething warp madness," Corbeck mused,
then lightened up as he realized that it may be Gaunt's work. He'd said it was going to distract and upset the captain. Baru came back to them.
"We've hit lucky, really lucky," he hissed. "You'd better see."
McCall was waiting in cover in an archway around the next bend. Ahead was a lighted hatchway.
"Infirmary," he whispered. "I went up close to the door. They've got Rawn in there."
"How many Janteen?"
"Two troopers, an officer, a colonel, and someone else. Robed. I didn't like the look of him at all."
A scream suddenly cut the air, sobbing down into a whimper. The five ghosts stiffened. It had been Rawn's voice. 16. The Navy trooper kicked Catherine's fallen body hard and then swung his shotgun round to finish him. Weapon violations sirens were sounding shrilly in the close air of the Munitorium store. The trooper pumped the loader grip and then was smashed sideways into the packing cartons to his left by a massive fist. Bragg lifted the crumpled form of the dazed trooper and threw him 10 meters down the vaultway. He landed hard, broken.
"Brinny! Brinny boy!"
Bragg called anxiously over the siren. Milo raised himself up from under the artificer. The shot had exploded the vista plate, just missing him.
"I'm okay," he said.
Bragg got the dazed Caffran to his feet as Bryn slid the tile from the artificer slot.
"Go," he said. "Go!"
In under a minute, they had rejoined Dorden, helping him to push his laden trolley back out of the vault. By then, Munitorium officials and Navy troopers were rushing in through the cage. Dorden was a master of nerve.
"Thank faith you're here," he bellowed, his voice cracking. "They are a Janteen in there, madmen. They attacked us. Your man engaged them, but I think they got him. Quickly, quickly now."
Most of the detail moved past at a run, racking weapons. One stayed, eyeing the ghost party cautiously.
"You'll have to wait. We're going to check this."
Dorden strode forward, steely calm now, and held up his data slate to show the man.
"Does this mean anything to you? A direct authorization from your captain? I've got a man dying in my infirmary. I need these supplies. Do you want a death on your hands? Because by faith, you're..."
The trooper waved them on and hurried after his comrades.
"I thought this place was meant to be secure,"
Dorden spat at the Munitorium official as they pushed past him towards the exit. They slammed the cart into a lift and slumped back against the walls as it began to rise.
"Did you get it?"
Dorden asked, after a few deep breaths. Milo nodded.
"Think so."
Caffran looked at the elderly doctor with a wide-eyed grin.
"They're a Janteen in there, madmen. They attacked us. Your man engaged them, but I think they got him. Quickly, what the feth was all that about?"
"Inspired, I'd say," Bragg said.
"Back home, I was a doctor, and also secretary of the County Prize Citizens' Players. My Prince Tagoth was highly regarded."
Their relieved laughter began to fill the lift. 17. Corbeck's revenge squad was about to move when the deck voxcasters started to relay the scream of a weapons violation alert. The dull choral wails echoed down the hallway, and alert runes began to blink above all of the archways. The colonel pulled his men into cover as figures strode out of the infirmary, looking around. Squads of Jantine guards came up from both sides, milling around as vox checks tried to ascertain the nature of the incident. Korbeck saw Flens and Brockus, the Jantine senior officers, and another man, a hugely tall and grotesque figure in shimmering smoke-like robes, who filled him with dread.
"Weapons discharge on the Munitorium deck,"
a Jantine trooper with a vox caster on his back reported.
"The Navy details are closing to contain it. Sir, the channels are alive with cross-reports. They're blaming it on the Jantine. They say we conducted a feud strike on Tanith scum in the supply vaults."
Flens cursed.
"Gaunt! The devil's tried to match our game."
He turned to his men.
"Brockus, secure the deck. Security detail, with me."
"I'll stay and finish my work,"
the robed figure said in a deep, liquid tone that quite chilled Korbeck. As the various men moved off to comply with orders, the robed figure stopped Flens with a hand to his shoulder. Or rather, what seemed more like a long-fingered claw than a hand, Korbeck noticed with a shudder.
"This isn't good, Flens,"
the figure breathed at the suddenly trembling colonel.
"Use violence against a soldier like Gaunt, and you can be assured he will use it back. And you seem to have underestimated his political abilities. I fear he has outplayed you. And if he has, you should fear for yourself."
Flens shook himself free and hurried away.
"I'll deal with it,"
he snarled defensively over his shoulder. The robed figure watched him leave and then withdrew into the infirmary.
"What do we do?" Varl hissed.
"Tell me we go back now,"
Larkin whispered urgently. Another scream issued from the chamber beyond. "What do you think?" Korbeck asked. 18. Sirens wailed in the normally tranquil Strategium. Grasticus shifted in his cot throne, wanding screens to him and cursing at the information he was reading. Gaunt and Zoran exchanged glances. "I hope this confusion is the confusion we planned," Gaunt thought. Grasticus rose up on his elbows and bawled at the quaking Leculanzi.
"Weapons fire on the Munitorium deck! My data says it's Jantine feuders!"
"Are any of mine hurt?" Gaunt asked, pushing forward, urgent. "I told you the Jantine were out for blood."
"Shut up, Commissar,"
the captain said with a suddenly sour look. His day had been disrupted enough.
"The reports are unconfirmed. Get down there and see to it, warrant officer."
Leculanzi scurried out of the chamber. Grasticus turned back to the two Imperial Guard colonels.
"This matter needs my undivided attention. I will summon you when we can speak further."
Zoran and Gaunt nodded and backed out of the Strategium smartly. Side by side, they crossed the nave of the bridge, through the hubbub of bridge crew, and entered the lifts.
"Is it working?"
Zoran asked as the doors closed and the choral chime sang out.
"Pray by the throne that it is,"
Gaunt said. 19. They took the infirmary in a textbook move. The room was wide, long and low. The robed figure was bent over Rorn, who was strapped, screaming to a gurney. A pair of Jantine troopers stood guard at the door. Korbeck came in between them, ignoring them both, as he dived into a roll, his shotgun raised up to fire. The robed figure turned, as if sensing the sudden intrusion. The shotgun blast blew him backwards into a stack of wheezing Resuscitrex units. The guards began to turn when McCall and Baru launched in on Korbeck's heels and knifed them both. Korbeck rolled up onto his feet, slung his shotgun by the strap, and grabbed Rorn.
"Sacred Feth," he murmured, as he saw the head wound and the insidious pattern of scalpel cuts across the major's face, neck, and stripped body.
Rorn was slipping in and out of consciousness.
"Come on, Rorn, come on,"
Korbeck snapped, hauling the major up over his shoulder.
"We have to move now,"
McCall bellowed, as secondary weapons violation sirens began to shrill. Korbeck threw the shotgun over to him.
"Take point. We shoot our way out if we have to."
"Colonel!"
Baru yelled. Weighed down by Rorn, Korbeck couldn't turn in time. The robed figure was clawing its way back onto its feet behind him. Its hood was thrown back, and they gasped to see the equine extension and bared teeth of the head. Fury boiled in the eyes of the man-monster, and violet dark energy crackled around him. Korbeck felt the room temperature drop. Fething magic was all he had time to think, before a shot took the man-monster's throat clean away. Larkin stood in the doorway, the old rifle raised in his hands. "Now we're leaving, right?" he said. 20. Gaunt took the tile Milo held out for him. Then he shut the door of his quarters on the faces of the men crowded outside. Inside, Korbeck, Zoran, and Milo watched him carefully.
"This had better be worth all that damn effort," Korbeck said eventually, voicing what they all thought.
Gaunt nodded. The gamble had been immense, but for the Jantines' bloodthirsty and brutal methods of pursuing their intrigue, they would never have got this far. The ship was still full of commotion. Adeptus Mechanicus security details clogged every corridor, conducting barrack searches. Rumor, accusation, and threat rebounded from counter-rumor, counter-accusation, and promise. Gaunt knew his hands weren't spotless in this, and he would make no attempt to hide that his men fought back against the Jantine in a feud. There would be reprimands, punishment details, rounds of questioning that would lead to nothing conclusive, but, like him, the Jantine would not take the matter beyond a simple regimental feud. Only he and those secret elements pitched against him would know precisely what had been at stake. He slotted the tile into his artificer, and then set the crystal in the reed slot. He touched a few keys. There was a pause.
"It isn't working," Zoran began.
It wasn't. As far as Gaunt could tell, Milo had indeed downloaded the latest clearance ciphers via the Munitorium artificer, but still, they would not open the crystal. In fact, he couldn't even open the ciphers and set them to work. Gaunt cursed.
"What about the ring?"
Milo asked. Gaunt paused, then fished Dercius's ring from his pocket. He fitted that into the reed slot beside the one that held the crystal, and activated it. Old and too out of date to open the dedicated ciphers of the crystal, the ring was nevertheless standardized in its cryptography enough to authorize use of the downloaded codes. The Vistaplate scrolled nonsense for a moment, as runic engram languages translated each other and overlaid data, transcribing and interpreting, rereading and resetting. The crystal opened, spilling its contents up in a hololithic display which projected up off the Vistaplate.
"Oh, Feth, what's this mean?"
Korbeck murmured, instantly overwhelmed by the magnitude of what he saw. Milo and Gaunt were silent as they read on for detail.
"Schematics,"
Zoran said simply, an awed note in his voice. Gaunt nodded.
"By the Golden Throne. I don't pretend to understand much of this, but from what I do... Now I see why they were so keen to get it."
Milo pointed to a sidebar of the display.
"A chart. A location. Where is that?"
Gaunt looked and nodded again, slowly. Things now made sense. Like why Ferrid had chosen him to be the bearer of the crystal. Things had just become a great deal harder than even he had feared.
"Menazoid Epsilon," he breathed.
A memory. Ked, 1173, 16 years earlier. The Kedite had not expected them to move in winter, but the High Lords of Terra's Imperial Guard, whose forces dwelt in seasonless shipholds plying the ever-cold of space, made no such distinction between campaigning months and resting months. They burned two clan towns at the mouth of the River Hiot, where the deep fjord inlets opened to the icy sea and the archipelago, and then moved into the glacial uplands to prosecute the nomads who had spent the summer harrying the main imperial outposts with guerrilla strikes. Up here, the air was clear like glass, and the sky was a deep, burnished turquoise. Their column of Chimera troop transports, ski-nosed half-tracks commandeered locally, hellhounds and Lehman Russ tanks with big bulldozer blades, made fast going over the sculptural ice desert, snorting exhaust smoke and ice spumes in their wake. The khaki body camouflage from their last campaign in the dust-thick heatlands of Providence Lenticula had been painted over with the leopard pelt speckles of grey and blue on white. Only the silver imperial eagles and the purple insignia of the Jantine patricians remained on the flanks of the rushing, bouncing, roaring vehicles. The sentinel scouts, stalking as swift outriders to the main advance, had located a nomad Haluka 3 kilometers away over a startlingly vivid glacier of green ice. General Aldo Dercius swung the column to a stop and sat on the turret top of his command tank, pulling off his fur mittens so he could sort through the sheaf of flimsy vista prints the sentinels had brought back. The Haluka seemed of normal pattern, a stockade of stripped fur stems surrounding 18 bulbous habitat tents of tanned mahish hide supported on umbrella domes of the animal's treated rib bones. There was a corral adjacent to the stockade, holding at least 60 anahig, the noxious, hunchbacked, flightless bird mounts that the Kedite favored. Damn things, ungainly and comical in appearance, but the biped steeds could run faster than an unladen chimera across loose snow, turn much faster, and the scales under their oily matted down fur could shrug off lasfire while their toothed beaks sliced a man in two like toffee. Dercius slid his flare goggles up for a better look at the vista prints, and winced at the glare of the open snow. Down on the prow of the Lehman Russ, his crew were taking time to stretch their limbs and relax. A stove boiled water for treacly caffeine, and Dercius's two adjutants stroke bodyguards were applying mahish fat to their snow-burned cheeks and noses out of small round tins they had bartered from the local population. Dercius smiled to himself at this little thing. His patricians had a reputation for aristo snobbery, but they were resourceful men, and certainly not too proud to follow the local wisdom and smear their faces with cetacean blubber to block the unforgiving winter suns. His face caked in the pungent white grease, Adjutant Brockus slid his tin away in the pocket of his fur-trimmed, purple and chrome patrician battle dress and took a wire-handled can of caffeine up to the turret. Dercius accepted it gratefully. Brockus, a young and powerfully built trooper, nodded down at the prince spread out on the turret canopy.
A target, or just another collection of thlack hunters?
I'm trying to decide, Dercius said. Since they had left the mouth of the Hiot 8 days before, they had made one early, lucky strike at a camp of nomad guerrilla Kedite, and then wasted 4 afternoons assaulting Halukas that had sheltered nothing more than herders and hunters in ragged family groups. Dercius was eager for another success. The Imperial Guard had strength, technology, and firepower in their corner, but the nomad rebels had patriotic determination, a fanatical mindset, and the harsh environment in theirs. Dercius knew that many campaigns had faltered when the initially victorious forces had driven the natives back onto the advantage of inhospitable home turf. The last thing he wanted was a war of attrition that locked him here in a police action against elusive guerrillas for years. The Kedite knew and used this beautiful, cruel environment well, and Dercius knew they could be hunting them for months, all the while suffering a slow erosion of strength to lightning strikes by the fast-moving foe. If they only had a base, a static HQ, a city that could be assaulted. But the Kedite culture out here was fierce and nomadic. This was their realm, and they would be masters of it until he could catch them. Still, he reassured himself that Warmaster Slado had promised him 3 more guard units to help his Janteen 4th and 11th in their hunt. Just a day or two more. He looked back at the prince and saw something.
This is promising, he told Brockus, sipping his caffeine. It's a large settlement, large by comparison with the herder stroke hunter Halukas we've seen. 60+ animals. Those Anahig are big. They look like war mounts to me.
Veritable destroyer, Brockus laughed, referring to the beautiful 16-hand beasts traditionally bred in the stud farms of the baronies on Jant Normandus Prime.
Dercius enjoyed the joke. It was the sort of quip his old major, Gaunt, would have made. A pressure release from the slow-building tension bubble of a difficult campaign. He rubbed the memory away. That was done. Left behind on Kentor.
Look here, he said, tapping a particular print.
Brockus leaned closer.
What does that look like to you?
Dercius asked.
The main habitat tent? Where your finger is?
I don't know. A smoke flue? An airspace?
Maybe,
Dercius said and lifted the print so that his adjutant could get a closer look.
There's certainly smoke issuing from it, but we all know how easy smoke is to make. That wink of light, there.
Brockus chuckled, nodding.
Throne. An uplink spine, no doubt. They've got a Vox Vista set in that place, with the mast extending up out of the opening. You've got sharp eyes, General.
That's why I'm the general, Trooper Brockus, Dercius snorted with ample good humor. So, what does that give us? A larger-than-normal Helluka, 60 head of Warmount in the pen?
And since when did Thlack herders need an intercontinental uplink unit? Finished the adjutant.
I think the Emperor has smiled at our fortune. Have Major Sawless circle the tanks into a crescent formation around the edge of the glacier. Bring the hellhounds forward and hold the troops back for final clearing. We will engulf them.
Brockus nodded and jumped back off the track bed of the Leman Russ, running to shout his orders. Dercius poured the last dregs of his caffeine away over the side of the turret. It melted and stained the snow beside the tank's treads. Just before sunset, with the first sun a frosty pink semicircle dipping below the horizon, and the second a hot apricot glow in the wispy clouds of the blackening sky, the Helluka was a dark stain too. The Kedite had fought ferociously, as ferociously as any fur-clad ice soldier whose tented encampment had been pounded by tank shells and hosed by infernos unleashed from the trundling hellhounds. Most of the dead and the debris were fused into thick curls of the rapidly refreezing ice cover. Twisted, broken, blackened shapes around which the suddenly liquid ice had abruptly solidified and set. Some 20 or so had made it to their Anahig mount and staged a countercharge along the north flank. A few of his infantry had been torn apart by the clacking beaks or churned under the heavy three-toed feet. Dercius had pulled the troops back and sent in the tanks with their relentless dozer blades. The sunset was lovely on Ked. Dercius pulled his vehicle up from the glacier slope until he overlooked the ocean. It was vibrant red in the failing light, alive with the flashing bioluminescence of the microgrowth and krill which prospered in the winter seas. Every now and then, the dying light caught the slow glitter of a mahish as it surfaced its great bulk to harvest the surface. Dercius watched the flopping thick red water for the sudden breaks of 20-meter flukes and dorsal spines and the sonorous sub-bass creaks of deep-water voices. The voxcaster set in the lit turret below him was alive with backchat, but he started as he heard a signal cut through, a low, even message couched in simple Jantine combat cant.
"Who knows that? Who's broadcasting?" he murmured, dropping into the turret and adjusting the dial of the set. He smiled at first.
Slado's promised reinforcements were coming in. The Hyakon 5th and 6th. The message was from the Hyakon Commissar, little Ibram Gaunt. Foglights lit the glacier crest as the armored column of the Hyakon hove into view, kicking up snow dust from their tracks as they bounced down towards the Jantine column. It would be good to see Ibram, Dercius thought. What's it been? 13? 14 years? He's grown up since I last saw him. Grown up like his father. Served with the Hyakon. Made commissar. Dercius had kept up with the long-range reports of Ibram's career. Not just an officer, as his father intended. A commissar, no less. Commissar Gaunt. Well, well, well. It would be good to see the boy again. Despite everything. Gaunt's half-track slewed up in the snow next to the general's Leman Russ. Dercius was descending to meet it, putting his cap on, adjusting his regimental chainsword in its decorative sheath. He hardly recognized the man who stepped out to meet him. Gaunt was grown. Tall, powerful, thin of face, his eyes as steady and penetrating as targeting lasers. The black uniform storm coat and cap of an imperial commissar suited him.
"Ibram," Dercius said with a slow smile. "How long has it been?"
"Yes," the commissar said flatly, face expressionless. "Space is wide and too broad to be spanned. I have looked forward to this. For too long. I always hoped circumstance would draw us together again, face to face."
"Ah, so did I, Ibram. It's a joy to see you."
Dercius held his arms out wide. "Because I am, as my father raised me, a fair man. I will tell you this, Uncle Dercius," Gaunt said, his voice curiously low. 4 years ago, on Darandara, I experienced a revelation. A series of revelations. I was given information. Some of it was nonsense, or was not then applicable. Some of it was salutary. It told me a truth. I have been waiting to encounter you ever since."
Dercius stiffened. "Ibram, my boy, what are you saying?" Gaunt unsheathed his chainsword. It murmured waspishly in the cold air.
I know what happened on Kentor. I know that, for fear of your own career, my father died.
Nurcius's adjutant was suddenly between them.
That's enough, Brockus spat. Back off!
Major Tannhaus and Sergeant Clef of the Hyakon stood ready to second Gaunt.
You're speaking to an Imperial Commissar, friend, Gaunt said. Think hard about your objections.
Brockus took a pace back, uncertainty warring with duty.
Now I am a Commissar, Gaunt continued, addressing Dercius. I am empowered to deliver justice wherever I see it lacking. I am empowered to punish cowardice. I am granted the gift of total authority to judge, in the name of the Emperor, on the field of combat.
Suddenly realizing the implications behind Gaunt's words, Dercius pulled his own chainsword and flew at the Commissar. Gaunt swung his own blade up to block, his grip firm. Madness and fear filled the Jantine commander.
How had the little bastard found out? Who could have known to tell him?
The calm confidence which had filled his mind since the Ked campaign began washed away as fast as the dying light was dulling the ice glare around them.
Little Ibram knew. He knew. After all this time, all his care, the boy had found out.
It was the one thing he always dreaded, always promised himself would never happen. The scything chainswords struck and shrieked, throwing sparks into the cold night, grinding as the tooth belts churned and repelled each other. Broken saw teeth spun away like shrapnel. Dercius had been tutored in the dueling schools of the Jant Normanidus Military Academy. He had the ceremonial honor scars on his cheek and forearms to bear it out. A chain blade was a different thing, of course, 10 times as heavy and slow as a coupe épée, and the clash torsion of the chewing teeth was an often random factor. But Dercius had retrained his swordsmanship in the nuances of the chainsword on admission to the patricians. A duel, chainsword to chainsword, was rare these days, but not unheard of. The secrets were wrist strength, momentum, and the calculated use of reversal in chain direction to deflect the opponent and open a space. There was no feinting with a weapon as heavy as a chainsword, only swing and readdress. They turned, clashed, broke, circled, clashed again. The men were calling out, others running to see. No one dared step in. From the frank determination of the officers, it was clear this was an honor bout. Nurcius hooked in low, cycling the action of his blade to a fast reversal, and threw Gaunt's weapon aside with a shriek of tortured metal. An opening. He sliced, and the sweep took Gaunt across the gut. His commissar's coat and tunic split open, and blood exploded from a massive cut across his lower belly. Gaunt almost fell. The pain was immense, and he knew the ripped, torn wound was terrible. He had failed. Failed his honor and his father. Dercius was too big, too formidable a presence in his mind to be defeated. Uncle Dercius, the huge man, the laughing, scolding, charismatic giant who had strode into his life from time to time on Manzipor, full of tales and jokes and wonderful gifts. Dercius, who had carved toy frigates for him, told him the names of the stars, sat him on his knee, and presented him with orc-tooth souvenirs. Dercius, who, with the aid of awning rods, had taught him to fence on the sun decks over the cataracts. Gaunt remembered the little twist-thrust that always left him sitting on his backside, rubbing a bruised shoulder. Deft with an épée, impossible with a chainsword. Or perhaps not. Trailing blood and tattered clothes and flesh, Gaunt twisted, light as a child, and thrust with a weapon not designed to be thrust. There was a look of almost unbearable surprise on Dercius's face as Gaunt's chainsword stabbed into his sternum and dug with a convulsive scream through bone, flesh, tissue, and organs until it protruded from between the man's shoulder blades, meat flicking from the whirring teeth. Dercius dropped in a bloody, quaking mess, his corpse vibrating with the rhythm of the still active weapon impaling it. Gaunt fell to his knees, clutching his belly together as warm blood spurted through the messy gut wound. He was blacking out as Tannhaus got to him.
You are avenged, father,
Ibram Gaunt tried to say to the evening sky, before unconsciousness took him. Part 6. Menazoid Epsilon 1. No one wanted Epsilon. No one wanted to die. Colonel Commissar Gaunt recalled his own deliberations in the glass bay of the Absalon with a rueful grin. He remembered how he had prayed his ghosts would be selected for the main offensive on the main planet, Menazoid Sigma. How things change, he laughed to himself. How he would have scoffed back then in the glass bay if he had been told he would deliberately choose this action. Well, choose was perhaps too strong a word. Luck and invisible hands had been at work. When the Absalon had put in at one of the huge beachhead hexathedrals strung out like beads across the Menazoid clasp, there had been a bewildering mass of regiments and armored units assembling to deploy at the Menazoid target zones. Most of the regimental officers had been petitioning for the glory of advancing on Sigma, and Warmaster Makaroth's tactical council had been inundated with proposals and counterproposals as to the disposition of the Imperial armies. Gaunt had thought of the way that Ferrid, the unseen Ferrid, and his network of operatives had arranged for the Vitrians to support him on the Absalom. With no direct means of communication, he trusted that they would observe him again and, where possible, facilitate his needs, tacitly understanding them to be part of the mutual scheme. So he had sent signals to the tactical division, announcing that he believed his ghosts, with their well-recognized stealth and scout attributes, would be appropriate for the Epsilon assault. Perhaps it was chance. Perhaps it was because no other regiment had volunteered. Perhaps it was that Ferrid and his network had noted the request and manipulated silently behind the scenes to ensure that it happened. Perhaps it was that the conspiring enemy faction, rebuffed in their attempts to extract the secrets of the crystal from him, had decided the only way to reveal the truth was to let him have his way and follow him. Perhaps he was leading them to the trophy they so desired. It mattered little. After a week and a half of levy organization, resupply, and tactical processing at the hexathedrals, the ghosts had been selected to participate in the assault on Menazoid Epsilon, advancing before an armored host of 40,000 vehicles from the Latari Gundogs, Ketzok 17th, Samothrace 4th, 5th and 15th, Borkelid Hellhounds, Cadian Armored 3rd, and Sarpoy Mechanized Cavalry. With the Tanith 1st in the field would be 8 Mordian and 4 Pragar regiments, the Afghali Ravagers 1st and 3rd, 6 battalions of Udino Irregulars, and the Vitrian Dragoons. The inclusion of the Vitrians gave Gaunt confidence that deployment decisions had been influenced by friendly minds. The fact that the Jantine Patricians were also part of the first wave, and that Lord General Dravir was in overall charge of the Epsilon Theatre, made him think otherwise. How much of it was engineered by Ferrid's hand? How much by the opposing cartel? How much was sheer happenstance? Only time would tell. Time and slaughter. The Lord General's strategists had planned out 6 dispersal sites for the main landing along a 120-kilometer belt of lowlands adjacent to a hill range designated Shrine Target Primaris on all field charts and signals. 4 more dispersal sites were spread across a massive salt basin below Shrine Target Secundus, a line of steeple cliffs 1,500 kilometers to the west, and 3 more were placed to assault Shrine Target Tertius on a wide oceanic peninsula 2,000 kilometers to the south. The waves of landing ships came in under cover of pre-dawn light, tinting the dark undersides of the clouds red with their burners and attitude thrusters. As the sun came up, pale and weak, the lightning sky was thick with ships. The heavyweight troop carriers, glossy like beetles, the smaller munitions and supply lifters moving in pairs and trios, the quick cross-cutting threads of fighter escort and ground cover, some orbital bombardment, jagging fire ripples of orbiter-surface missiles, and the occasional careful stamp of a massive beam weapon softened the empty highlands above the seething dispersal fields. Down in the turmoil, men and machines marshaled out of black ships into the dawn light. Troop components formed columns or waiting groups, and armor units ground forward, making their own roads along the lowlands, assembling into packs and advance lines on the churned, rolling grasses. The air was thick with exhaust fumes, the growl of tank engines, the roar of ship thrusters, and the crackle of vox chatter. Platoon strength retinues set dispersal camps, lit fires, or were seconded to help erect the blast tents of the field hospitals and communication centers. Engineer units dug fortifications and defense baffles. Munitorium supply details broke out the crates from the materiel ships and distributed assault equipment to collection parties from each assembling platoon. Amid the hue and cry, the ministerium priesthood moved solemnly through their flock, chanting, blessing, swinging incense burners, and singing unceasing hymns of valor and protection. Gaunt came down the bow ramp of his dropship into the early morning air and onto a wide mud plain of track-chewed earth. The noise, the vibration, the petrochemical smell was intense and fierce. Lights flashed all around, from campfires and hooded lanterns, from vehicle headlights, from the winking hazard lamps of landing ships, or the flicking torch poles of dispersal officers directing disembarking troop columns or packs of offloading vehicles. He looked up at the highland slopes beyond, wide, rising hills thick with dry, ochre bracken. Beyond them was the suggestion of crags and steeper summits. The target, Primaris. There, if the Vermilion level data was honest, lay the hopes and dreams of Lord High Militant General Drevere and his lackeys, the destiny of Ibram Gaunt and his ghosts, too. Further down the field, devourer dropships slackened their metal jaws and disgorged the infantry. The ghosts came out blinking, in platoon formation, gazing out at the rolling ochre-clad hills in the low, puffy cloud cover. Gaunt moved them up and out, under direction of the marshals, onto the rise that was their first staging post. Clearing the exhaust smog which choked the dispersal site, they got their first taste of Menazoid Epsilon. It was dry and cool, with a cutting wind and a permeating scent of honeysuckle. At first, the sweet, cold smell was pleasing and strange, but after a few breaths it became cloying and nauseating. Gaunt signaled his disposition and quickly received the command to advance as per the sealed battle orders. The ghosts moved forward, rising up through the bracken, leaving countless trodden trails in their wake. The growth was hip-high and fragile as ash, and the troopers were encumbered by tripping roots and wiry sedge weeds. Gaunt led them to the crest of the hill and then turned the regiment west, as he had been ordered. 2 kilometers back below them, on the busy dispersal field, burners flared and several of the massive dropships rose, swinging low above the hillside, shuddering the air and billowing up a storm of bracken fibers as they lifted almost impossibly into the cloudy sky. 3 kilometers distant, Gaunt could see through his scope 2 regiments of Mordian Iron Guard forming up as they advanced from their landing points. Another 2 kilometers beyond them, the Vitrian Dragoons were advancing from their first staging. The rolling, hilly landscape was alive with troops, clusters of black dots marching up from the blasted acres of the dispersal site, forward through the scrub. By mid-morning, the parallel advancing regiments of Imperial Guard armor and infantry were pushing like fingers through the bracken and scree-marked slopes of the highlands. At the dispersal sites now left far behind, ships were still ferrying components of the vast assault down from orbit. Thruster roar rolled like faraway thunder around the sleeve of hills. They began to see the towers, 40 meter tall, irregular piles of jagged rock rising out of the bracken every 500 meters or so. Gaunt quickly passed the news on to command and heard similar reports on the Voxcaster's cross-channel traffic. There were lines of these towers all across the highland landscape. They looked like they had been piled from flat slabs, wide at the base, narrowing as they rose, and then wider and flat again at the top. They were all crumbling, mossy, haphazard, and in places time had tumbled some of their number over in wide spreads of broken stone, half hidden amidst the bracken. Gaunt wasn't sure if they were natural outcrops. Their spacing and linear form seemed to suggest otherwise. He was disheartened as he remembered the singular lack of data on Epsilon that had been available at the orbital preparatory briefings. Possibly a shrine world had been the best the intelligence cadre had had to offer. The surface of the planet is covered in inexplicable stone structures, arranged in lines that converge on the main areas of ruins, the targets Primaris, Secundus, and Tertius. Gaunt sent McColl's scouting platoon ahead, around the breast of the hill, through a line of mouldering towers, and into the valley beyond. He flipped out the data slate which he had secreted in his storm coat pocket for 2 days, and consulted the crystal's data. Calling up Trooper Raflan, he took the speaker horn from the fieldcaster on his back and relayed further orders. His units would scout ahead, and the Mordians, advancing in their wake, would lay behind until he signaled. It was now local noon. Turning back to his men, Gaunt saw Major Rawn nearby, standing in a grim hunch, his lasgun hanging limply in his hands. Gaunt had all but refused to allow Rawn to join them, but the hexathedral medics had pronounced him fit. He was a shadow of his former self since the torture by the Janteen and that mysterious robed monster which Larkin had shot. Gaunt missed the waspish, barbed attitude that had made Rawn a dangerous ally and a good squad leader. Fagor, his adjutant, was here too. His life owed to Dawdon. Fagor was a loose cannon now, an angry man with an axe to grind. He'd railed against the Janteen in the barracks and cursed that they were sharing this expedition. Gaunt feared what might happen if the ghosts and the Janteen crossed on Epsilon, particularly without Rawn sharp enough to keep his adjutant in line. What will happen, Gaunt decided, hearing Ferrid's counsel in his head. He checked his bolt gun for luck and was about to turn and tell Milo to play up when the shivering notes of a march spilled from the chanters of the Tanith pipes and echoed across the curl of the valley. They were here. Now they would do this. 2. Lord General Drevere's command Leviathan, a vast, armored, trundling fortress the size of a small city, crawled forward across the loamy soil of the lowland slope, overlooking one of the main dispersal sites for the Primaris target. At its heart, Drevere swung around in his leather command G-hammock. He was in a good mood. Thanks to his urgent requests, Warmaster Makaroth had personally instructed him the command of the Epsilon offensive. The fool. Here lay the secret that the freak beast Heldane had told him of on Fortis Binary. The reward. The prize that would win him everything. Drevere had spent 2 days reviewing the available data on Menazoid Epsilon before the drop. Little more than a moon compared to its vast partner Sigma, it was reckoned to be a shrine world to the Dark Powers. Vast, mouldering structures of inexplicable ancient design dominated the northern uplands, arranged in patterns that could only be appreciated from high orbit. The vast bulk of the Chaos Legions arrayed against them had dug in to defend their cities on the primary world, but intelligence reports had picked up hints of an unknown mass of defense established here. It was clear that, though there was no obvious wealth or value to the moon world, the foe regarded it as significant. Why else would they have risked splitting their forces? Drevere had heard talk of simply obliterating Epsilon from orbit, but had fiercely vetoed the Navy plan. He wanted Epsilon taken on the ground, so that they might capture and examine whatever it was the enemy held in such regard. That was the authorized explanation for this assault. Drevere knew more. He knew that the fact the rebellious Gaunt had requested this theater alone made it significant. Drevere readied himself. He knew how to use manpower. He had based his career upon it. He would use Gaunt now. The Commissar had not given up the priceless data, so they would instead use Gaunt to lead them to it. Drevere pulled on a lever to rotate his command hammock, speed-reading the deposition reports from the repeater plates that hung around his station. He linked in with the command globes of Marshal Sendak and Marshal Tarantine, who were overseeing the assaults on target locations Secundus and Tertius, respectively. They reported their dispersal complete and their forces in advance. No contact with any enemy thus far. The afternoon was half gone, and the first day with it. Drevere was unhappy that fighting had not yet begun at any of the three battlefronts, but he was gratified in the knowledge that he had supervised the landing of an expeditionary force of this size, divided between three targets, in less than a single day. He knew a few Imperial Guard commanders who could have done the same in treble that time. He selected other plates and surveyed the disposition of the army under his direct command, the Primaris invasion. The infantry regiments were down and advancing strongly from the dispersal sites, and the motorized armor were disembarking from their landing craft into the lower valleys. He was pushing on three prongs to encircle the ancient mountainside structures of Shrine Target Primaris, fanning his armor out to support three infantry advances, led by the Mordian to the west, the Latari to the east, and the Tanith to the south. So far, there had been no sign of an enemy to engage. No sign at all, in fact, that there were anything other than Imperium forces alive on Epsilon. Drevere took up a stylus and inscribed a short message on a data slate to Colonel Flens of the Janteen. Flens would be his eyes and ears on the ground, tailing the Tanith ghosts and standing ready to intercede. Gaunt's advance was the only one he was interested in. Drevere coded the message in Janteen combat cant and broadcast it to the patricians on a stammered vox burst. Flens would not fail him. He sat back in his harness and allowed a smile to cross his thin lips. He knew this gambit would cost him, but he had lives enough to pay. The lives of the 50,000 infantry under his command here on Epsilon. He considered them a down payment on his apotheosis. He decided to take the opportunity to rest and meditate. The second day was dawning when he returned to his command hammock and overviewed the intelligence from the night. All of his units had advanced as expected until dark and then established watch camps and stagings. At first light, they were moving again. The night had brought no sign of the foe, nor had Revere expected such news. His staff would have roused him immediately at the first shot fired. Chatter and industry filled the command globe beyond the circular guardrail surrounding his hammock pit. Navy officers and munitorium aides, mixed with guard tactical officials and members of his own staff, manning the artificers and codifiers, processing, analyzing, and charting movement on the huge hololithic deployment map, a three-dimensional light shape projecting down from the domed roof. A sudden call rang through the deck.
Marshal Tarantine reports his Cadian and Afghali units have engaged. Heavy fighting now at Shrine Target Tertius.
First blood, Drevere thought. At last. Red indicator runes flashed on the continental deployment map. Stains of telltale brown and crimson shone out to delineate firefight spread and range at the Tertius location. Enemy positions flashed into life as they were assessed, appearing as aggressive little yellow stars. He issued more orders, bringing the heavy artillery and tanks around to begin bombardment to cover Tarantine's line. Two more heavy fighting zones erupted on the map as the Secundus push suddenly ground hard into hidden enemy emplacements. A counter-bombardment opened up from the enemy forces. More stains, more yellow stars. Drevere kept one eye fixed on the jinking signals that flagged the swift Tanith advance, with Mordian, Jantine, and Vitrian columns at its heels. The Primaris assault was unopposed so far.
"It begins, Lord,"
a voice said to his left. Drevere looked up into the face of Imperial tactician Wayland. Wayland was a grizzled, bald man with a commanding frame and piercing eyes. He wore the black and red braid uniform of Makaroth's tactical advisers, but Drevere had known who the man really was when he first met him. A spy, a watcher, an observer sent by Makaroth to supervise Drevere's efforts.
"Your assessment, Wayland?"
Drevere said smoothly. The tactician scrutinized the deployment map.
"We expected fierce resistance. I anticipate they have more than this up their sleeves."
"Nothing yet here at Primaris. We expected this to be the worst, didn't we?"
"Indeed."
Wayland seemed oblivious to Drevere's sarcasm.
"Not yet, but it will come. If this is the shrine world we fear it to be, their defense will be more indomitable and fanatical than we can imagine. Do not advance your forces too swiftly, Lord General, or you will render them vulnerable and overextended."
Drevere wished he could tell the tactician exactly what he thought of his advice, but Wayland was part of Makaroth's military aristocracy, and an insult would be counterproductive. He wanted to shout, "I've dispersed this invasion faster and more efficiently than any commander in the field, and you dare advise me to slow?" But he simply nodded, biting his tongue for now. Wayland sat on the guardrail and sighed reflectively.
"It's been a long time for us, eh, Hector?"
Drevere looked at him crossly.
"Long time? What do you mean?"
Wayland smiled at him.
"The heat of combat. We were both foot sloggers once. Last action I saw was against the accursed Eldar, on Ondermanx. 20 years passed. Now we're data slate watchers, plate pushers. Command is an honorable venture, but sometimes I miss the sweat and toil of combat."
Drevere licked his lips at the delicious thought which had just come to him.
"I can use any able-bodied, willing fighting man, Wayland. Do you want to get out there?"
Wayland looked startled for a moment, then grinned suddenly, getting up.
"I never refuse such an opportunity. The combat technique of this much-celebrated Tanith regiment fascinates me. I'm sure the Tactical Council could incorporate many new ideas from close observation of their stealth methods. With your permission, I'd gladly join them."
"You're so damn transparent," Drevere thought sullenly. "You want to see for yourself, don't you?" But he also knew he couldn't argue. To deny an Imperial tactician now might risk compromising his plan. I can deal with you later, he decided.
Would you care to deploy in the field as an observer? I could always use an eye on the ground.
With your permission, Whelan said, making to leave. I'll take a chimera from the reserve and move up the line. I have a detail of bodyguards who can act as a fireteam squad. Naturally, I'll report all findings to you.
Naturally,
Dravir agreed humorlessly.
I'll enter your identifier on the chart. Your battle code will be... what?
Whelan seemed to think for a moment.
How about my old unit call sign? Eagle Shard.
Dravir noted it and passed the details to his aide.
Good hunting, tactician,
he said, as the man left the command dome. 3. Gaunt looked up from the inscription that Communications Officer Rafflin had made of the intercepted vox burst.
Mean anything to you, sir? He asked. I logged it yesterday afternoon.
Gaunt nodded. It was a message in Janteen combat cant. Watchful of Makaroth's agencies, he had instructed Rafflin to keep his voxcast unit open to listen for all battlefield traffic. The message was from Dravir to Flens, a direct order to shadow the ghosts. Gaunt rubbed his chin. Slowly the enemies were showing their hand. He looked ahead, up at the high mountain pass, choked with bracken, and its lines of slumping towers. He was tempted to send Rorn back down the slope to mine the way in advance of the Janteen at their heels, but when all was said and done, they were on the same side. Word had come that the fighting had opened at the other two target sites, heavy and bloody. There was no telling what they would encounter up ahead in the thin altitude. He dared not drive back the units which might be the only forces to support the Tanith in a direct action. Gaunt pulled a notepad from the pocket of his storm coat and consulted several pages that Colonel Zorin had written. Carefully, with uncertainty, he composed a message in the Vitrian battlefield language using the code words Zorin had told him. Then he had Rafflin send it.
Speaking in tongue, sir,
the Vox officer laughed, ironically using the Tanith's own war dialect that Gaunt had made sure he had learned early on. Many of the regiments used their own languages or codes for internal messages. On the battlefield, secrecy was imperative in Vox commands, and Dravir couldn't know Gaunt had a working knowledge of Janteen combat cant. Gaunt called up Sergeant Blaine.
Take the 7th platoon and function as a rear guard, he told Blaine directly.
You expecting a hindquarters strike then?
Asked Blaine, puzzled.
McCall's scouts have covered the hill line. The enemy won't be sneaking round on us.
Not the given enemy, Gaunt said. I want you watching for the Janteen who are following us up. Our code word will be Ghostmaker. Given from me to you, or you back to me, it will indicate the Janteen have made a move. I don't want to be fighting our own, but it may come to that. When you hear the word, do not shrink from the deed. If you signal me, I will send everything back to support you. As far as I am concerned, the Janteen are as much our foe as the things that dwell up here.
Understood,
Blaine said, looking darkly at his commander. Corbeck had briefed the senior men well after Gaunt's unlocking of the crystal. They knew what was at stake, and were keeping the thought both paramount and away from their men, who had enough to concern them. Gaunt had a particular respect for the gruff, workmanlike Blaine. He was as gifted and loyal an officer as Corbeck, McColl, or Lerod, but he was also dependable and solid. Almost despite himself, Gaunt found himself offering Blaine his hand. They shook. Blaine realized the weight of the duty, the potentially terrible demands.
Emperor go with you, sir,
he said, as he broke the grip and turned to retreat down the bracken slope.
And may he watch over you, Gaunt returned.
Nearby, Milo saw the quiet exchange. He shook spit from the chanters of his Tanith pipes and prepared to play again. This is it, he thought. The Commissar expects the worst. Sergeant McColl's scouts were returning from the higher ground. Gaunt joined them to hear their report.
I think it's best if you see it yourself, McColl said simply, and gestured back at the heights.
Gaunt spread the fire teams of 3 platoons along the width of the valley slope, and then moved forward with McColl's scout unit. By now, all of the ghosts had rubbed the absorbent fabric of their stealth cloaks with handfuls of ochre bracken and dusted them so that they blended into the ground cover. Gaunt smiled as McColl scolded the Commissar's less than Tanith-like abilities and scrupulously dampened down the color of Gaunt's cloak with a scrub of ashy bracken. Gaunt removed his cap and edged forward, trying to hang the cloak around him as deftly as the Tanith scout. Behind them, there were 2,000 ghosts on the bracken-thick mountainside, but their commanding officer could see none of them. He reached the rise and borrowed McColl's scope as they bellied down in the fern and the dust. He hardly needed the scope. The rise they were ascending dropped away, and a cliff face rose vertically ahead of them, looking like it was 10,000 meters tall. The milky blue granite face was carved into steps like a ziggurat. A vast, steepled formation of weather-worn stories, rows of archways and slumped blocks. Gaunt knew that this was his first look at Shrine Target Primaris. Other than that, he had no idea what it was. A burial place? A temple? A dead hive? It simply smacked of evil. Of the darkness. A vile corruption seeped up from every pore of the rock face, every dark alcove and pillared recess.
I don't like the look of it, McColl said flatly.
Gaunt smiled grimly and consulted his own data slate.
Neither do I. We don't want to approach it directly. We need to sweep around to the left and follow the valley line.
Gaunt scoped down to the left. The carved granite structure extended away beyond the curve of the vale, and several of the stalking lines of towers marched up the bracken slopes to meet it, as if they were feelers spread out from the immense shrine itself. Beyond and higher, he could now see towers of blue granite in the clouds, spires, steeples, and buttresses. This was just the outskirts of an ancient necropolis, a city long dead that had been raised by inhuman hands before the start of recorded time. The honeysuckle scent in the air was becoming a stench. Vox-level chatter over the microbead in his ear told him that his men were starting to succumb to a vague, indefinable nausea.
"You want to go left?" McColl asked.
"But that's not in accord with the order of battle."
"I know. The Lord General will be furious if we divert from the given advance."
"I have my own orders," Gaunt said, tapping his data slate.
"And the Emperor love you for your loyalty," McColl shook his head.
"Sir, we were told to assault this place, directly."
"And we will, McColl. Just not here."
McColl nodded.
"How far down?"
"A kilometer or two. The crystal spoke of a dome. Find it for me."
"Gladly," McColl said.
"You know that if we alter our advance, it will give the Jantine dogs more reason to come for us."
"I know," Gaunt said. More than ever, he appreciated the way his senior officers had accommodated the truth of their endeavor. They knew what was at stake and what the real dangers were.
McColl and Corporal Baru led the advancing ghosts along the top of the valley, just under the crest, and past the threatening tower-haunted steps of the graven hillside. Scout Trooper Thark was the first to spot it. He voxed back to the command group. A dome, a massive bulbous dome swelling from the living rock of the cliff face, impossibly carved from granite. Gaunt moved up to see it for himself. It was like some vast stone onion, 1,000 meters in diameter, sunk into the stepped rock wall around it, the surface inscribed with billions of obscure sigils and marks. Thark was also the first to die. A storm of autocannon rounds whipped up the slope, exploding bracken into dust, spitting up soil and punching him into 4 or 5 bloody parts. At the queue, other weapon placements in the step alcoves of the facing cliff opened fire, raining lasfire, bullets, and curls of plasma down at the ghosts. The answering fire laced a spider's web of laslite, tracer lines, and firewash between the sides of the valley. The dying began. 4. Marshal Gol Sendak, the so-called Ravager of Genestock Gamma, had abandoned his command Leviathan to lead his forces from the front. He rode a Leman Russ battle tank of the Borkhelid regiments, heading a fast-moving armored phalanx that was smashing its way across the rocky escarpments below the weathered stone structures of Shrine Target Secundus. Laying down a ceaseless barrage, they broke through 2 lines of crumbling curtain walls and into the lower perimeters of the shrine structure itself. Wide, rubble-strewn slopes faced them, dotted with the lines of those infernal towers. Sendak voxed to the Udino infantry at his tail and urged them to follow him in. Fire as heavy as he had ever known blazed down from the archways and alcoves facing them. Sendak felt a dry stinging in his nose and snorted it away. That damn honeysuckle odor. It was beginning to get to him like it was getting to his men. He felt a wetness heavy his moustache and wiped it. Fresh blood smeared his grey cloth sleeve.